Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S. Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the greatest generation Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. How are you doing, Adam? I don't know why I put it in that tone of voice. How are you doing, Adam?
Great, Ben.
What is it about the fact that we're recording this that makes me act weird?
I don't know. It's unusual, certainly.
Yeah.
Because I know in real life you are
never
way, way more uncomfortable.
It has been a really long time, Adam. A dog's age, I might say, since we whipped out the cards that we used to play Card War.
Oh, yeah. It's a beloved kind of Marin Open for the greatest generation. Yeah. I would like to do a little Card War with you.
Let's do it.
We're at war.
There's been no formal declaration of war.
Maybe this trip will bring us some luck.
That nonsense is centuries behind us.
War! Go to war!
We have been the recipients of a lot of different kinds of cards from our viewers.
Yeah.
And the ones that I grabbed for this time around are the Deep Space Nine Memories from the Future trading cards. And the reason that I grabbed these is because stamped on each pack says, look for the autograph cards.
Oh, wow.
So I am hoping to get one of those as I play Card War.
Oh, interesting. So you're playing with cards that are not the collectible card game.
Right, and I think that's just fine because the way you and I play Card War is we flip over a card and then we just kind of make the case for the one card being better than the other.
Right, yeah. Sometimes we defer to the integrity and cunning stats or whatever, but...
But in this case, I will be deferring to the autograph.
All right. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I have two paths I could go down here. I have a packet of collectible card game cards still sealed in package with the Jim Shimoda card printed and adhesive to the front. I think somebody brought a bunch of these to maybe a Sketchfest show we did a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
And that turned up when I rifled through my stuff. And then I also have, still cellophaned in a box 4,917 of 6,000, a 24-pack box of complete Star Trek The Next Generation trading cards, Series
Whoa.
2, 1991 through 94.
Whoa.
So I have got our new challenge coin here. The Kevin Uxbridge Fan of Special Conscience Challenge Coin. And I guess I'm going to go heads for TNG, tails for collectible card game. And I'm going to flip this coin and to decide which of these two packets I'm going to take to the battlefield against the cards that you have brought.
Give it a flip.
All right. It's on the back of my palm. And it's tails. Collectible card game it is. The cellophane on this 24-pack box will remain unpierced.
Hey, that's great.
That's gonna... The collectors in the audience are really gonna appreciate that.
One thing that I've been made to remember after opening my first pack of these DS9 cards is that the cards are stuck together.
Oh, yeah!
Listen to this.
Sounds like a magazine you find in the woods.
Giving them a good crack is the only way to separate them from each other.
Wow.
Which means the autograph that I'm sure to find is going to be valueless.
All right. What do you say we flip over our first pair of cards here?
Let's do it. 3, 2, 1.
Oh, man. I have Engineer Lieutenant Tarek. And this is a this is a character familiar to us. It's Lieutenant Tarek, the Vulcan engineer from the Below Decks episode.
Hey, he's got that guy.
Integrity of 7, a cunning of 7, and a strength of 8. Look at the big muscles on Tarek.
Ben, I have what has been branded to be a greatest moment in DS9.
Uh-huh.
That greatest moment is the happy couple, and it is a picture of Worf and Jadzia Dax. Jadzia Dax sort of sitting on Worf's lap, his arms around her in an embrace. Unclear whether or not we can agree with this at this moment in time. We're about in the middle point of season 5 of Deep Space Nine.
I bet she really gets a lot out of sitting on his face. You know, a lot of ribbing to rub against, you know? Very stimulating.
You think Worf gets bored giving oral to Dax because he's always, like, looking for two clits that aren't there?
This is half as fun.
Not needing to search for a second clit is without honor.
I mean, I feel like he probably has the same problem down there that he does just opening any door.
Yeah. I gotta say, I think the degree to which I disagree with the happy couple is a reason why your card is going to win this round.
Wow.
What do you think?
Well, it's charitable. I like Dax and Worf together. I think I think the unconventionalness of their relationship is part of what makes it fun.
I'm famous for my grudge holding, Ben, and I just can't get over what Worf did on the Pleasure Planet.
Yeah. That's the scariest thing about you by a country mile. You always say that to me, one of your closest friends and business partners, that you're famous for your grudge holding.
Yeah, it's the main thing about me.
Wow.
So 1-0, Benjamin R. Harrison.
I feel less comfortable about winning. All right, let's flip over another card. 3, 2, 1.
Oh, Ben, in keeping with our romance theme of the cards on my side, I have found one of the greatest moments of Deep Space Nine to be a kiss. And that, of course, being the kiss between Dax and Nilani Khan, the lady kiss of a couple of seasons ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right? It was the Forbidden Love episode.
Right. And it was forbidden because it was like a former lover of Dax.
Yeah, and you're supposed to, you know, the one thing about the Trill is that they are also famous grudge holders.
Right.
You're not supposed to have relationships with people you have when you're wearing a different body.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Forbidden stuff.
Very forbidden.
What do you got?
I have an interrupt card, and it's emergency transporter armbands. It's a close-up of a gadget on an armband on somebody's command series uniform. Devices which allow quick remote activation of a transporter when in danger. I think you've really got me beat bad on this one.
I think so too. I don't think anyone's gonna remember that the way they do.
Emergency transporter armbands are some cowardly shit.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so one up.
We're in agreement on that.
Shall we hit another card?
Yeah, let's do it.
3, 2, 1. Okay, I have Particle Fountain, experimental orbital station built by Dr. Farallon for mining a planet from space, rumored to be effective for atmospheric depletion. So, Particle Fountain was the nickname everybody called me in college, but it's also the card that I flipped over.
Particle Fountain stands no chance against the wormhole.
Oh.
Of course, it being one of the greatest moments in Deep Space Nine. The picture on this card is great. It's of Captain Sisko, who at the time, I believe, was a commander. He is experiencing the beachiness of being in the wormhole. Like when he goes to visit the Founders, there's that vision of him on the beach.
Yeah.
With his wife.
Do you realize how incredible this is?
Yeah. Ha ha.
Yeah. Man, so if my particle fountain could hold a candle to a wormhole any day of the week, that would be great for me.
Yeah. It really feels like Sisko's getting something from this. His eyes are closed. He's in a state of great calm. Mm. Looks like a great moment. Maybe the greatest moment, according to this card.
God damn it. Okay, 2-1. You want to do best of 5?
Yeah, let's do... this could be the last one, then.
I guess so, yeah. You could you could
this is
you
big.
Could finish me off right here, right now.
I could finish off your particle fountain for you.
That's called a happy ending.
3, 2, 1.
Phew. I have a aphasic organism. And,
Is that when you, is that when you masturbate without touching yourself? Like Sting?
Yeah, like Sting. It says, a male non-corporeal life form that lives inside a female host, which he enchants, as in the case of Beverly Crusher's late grandmother. This is the candle being that bangs.
Oh, it's
Dr. Beverly.
It's candle fuckers.
Yeah.
Wow.
Quite a bit more of a legendary, century-spanning, intergalactic stick man than I've ever had before.
About that. I have got something sort of related to that. It's Bajor stay out is the quote next to greatest moments. And it has to do with the episode from a couple episodes ago of The Greatest Generation. It's about it's Rapture.
Wow.
It's the one where Captain Sisko experienced the visions called Patem Far.
Yeah.
It's the one where he finds the obelisk, right?
Right.
And then he busts into that chamber and breaks up the acceptance of Bajor into the Federation.
Right.
Yeah. So pretty recent, this one. Pretty wild. Yeah. I don't... A greatest moment, though? I don't know about that.
I mean, we're kind of picking what many people consider to be the worst episode of TNG versus an okay episode of Deep Space Nine.
All right. I mean, when put that way, I think we know what the math indicates. And that is, that's a win for me. There's our third out of 5.
No,
win again.
I dispute. I want a recount. I said intergalactic century-spanning stick man, Adam. Yours is just an inert obelisk.
All right, fine. The recount stands. We are now going to...
The Supreme Court is not going to intervene and name a winner.
Yeah.
We're going to have to take this into a runoff, Adam. A final card.
Let's do it. 3, 2, 1. Boy, I kind of getting the bends because the last card you had one of the worst episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. And what I am holding is a card for what I have heard is the best episode of Deep Space Nine.
Whoa.
The card is for Sisko, the sci-fi writer. And of course, it is related to the episode that we haven't gotten to yet called Far Beyond the Stars.
Wow.
And even someone like me who hasn't seen all of Deep Space Nine knows of this episode. It's the favorite of many people.
You've heard its legend.
Yeah. So that's what I've got. What are you packing?
I am packing Mendon, the chaotic bro, the ensign from the Benzite people. He's a representative of science specialists within Starfleet, served aboard the USS Entrepreneur in 2365. Looks like Mordok.
You did it, Ben. You came from behind and you beat me. Believe it.
Kind of a dubious win. I don't feel great about this win, but I'll take it.
But it's obvious. Chaotic Bro, one of the beloved characters on The Greatest Generation.
Yeah. Wow.
Obviously.
Woo!
That's tough. I don't feel good, but you won fair and square.
Well, Adam, I think we got to start to turn our attention toward matters more serious.
A different kind of war. A real war, even.
Yeah. And by that, we mean the coming Dominion War, which is really starting to pop off. It's season 5, episode 15, by Inferno's Light, part 2.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
Last time on Star Trek gets me every time.
Yeah.
And now the conclusion, like, it's a total pump up. I love it. I never skip that.
I'm always down for it, yeah. Show me the recap.
Yeah. Yeah. The recap is something that Star Trek Discovery does every episode, right? Do you get recap fatigue, you think, if it's in every episode? I don't think so.
I don't. And I think that there are enough concurrent story threads in Star Trek Discovery that I appreciate the fact that they're reminding me of some key points, because they don't always advance every storyline in every episode. So if a couple of episodes have gone by, I might need that to refamiliarize myself.
It also feels like cheap heat too. Like, the stuff's already been shot. You got 30 seconds for a little bit of a sizzle reel. Feels like it could be done. Especially, like, I think every episode has a commercial for it too.
Right.
When it was on television.
Right.
So why not?
That's Take advantage.
More sizzle. More sizzle for that steak.
So yeah, we've got the flotilla of ticks hovering outside the station. Kira is in command of the little D, with Dax on tactical, and they are spoiling for a fight. There's Gul Dukat's bird of prey and a couple of runabouts and the little D and about 75 ships that have just come through the wormhole from the G quad.
I don't like their chances.
Ew. I kind of wondered in planning this how much psychological ops the founders factored into it, because these ticks come through and stop with kind of all of their guns pointed at Deep Space Nine's head, give it a beat, and then turn and just head directly toward Cardassia. Like, they didn't need to stop, but they did.
They really have a flair for the dramatic, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, very dramatic.
I can appreciate that.
The Dukat warbird is in hot pursuit, and everybody's like, Dukat, you're nuts. Like, we had pretty long odds to begin with. You can't take these guys on all by yourself. And he radios back, no, I am not, in fact, trying to fight them. I'm heading there with them. Yeah. Returning to Cardassia as a homecoming hero, he's been engaged in some kind of gonzo diplomacy, and he has forged an alliance that causes Cardassia to enter the Dominion as one of its client states.
You can't be serious.
And Dukat, it gets to be like the Fidel Castro of Cardassia.
It's a great deal for him, but it's an absurd scene, right? Like, Gul Dukat returning to his homeworld in a Klingon ship, escorting 80 ticks.
Right.
I would love to have seen a cut to Cardassia at the moment of his arrival.
Yeah, that would have been real.
That must have felt so good for him to FaceTime his homeworld and be like,
honey, I'm home.
That's our smash to credit sequence. And when we come back, we're catching up with General Martok and Worf and Prime Bashir and Garak.
The real prisoners of Camp 371.
Yeah. I guess Martok is the one that keeps having to go fight Jem'Hadars. And the idea is hatched that they're going to go into this hatch in the wall. And there was a life support system in there that, you know, wasn't being used. And that's what Anabran Tain was using to send out his alive, alive, alive distress signal.
And in parentheses, I'm a childless older man. Alive in parentheses, I have no son. Alive in parentheses, I have no son.
Right. And so the thought is, if they can modify this thing, they might be able to, remote control the runabout to beam everyone up, and they'll be able to head out and return to Deep Space Nine with all the prisoners.
Ben, were you like, what? The runabout is still out there? How is that possible?
Yeah, I wondered about that. Like, shouldn't the Dominion be dismantling it and examining its technology or something?
It should be in a cargo bay being torn sheet metal from sheet metal.
Or just in like a big warehouse, like maybe next to the Ark of the Covenant.
That belongs in a museum!
I don't get that.
Well, there is a lot of hubris in the way the Jem'Hadar operate, so...
Yeah,
presume,
that's fair.
I think it's possible to overlook this plot hole.
I guess I'll have to.
Yeah, you are going to have to, because the episode certainly does. They're about to get started on this project when everybody gets called out to kind of the main hall of this prison, and a Vorta is there, and he announces, "Hey, great news for all the Cardassians. Diplomatic relations between our people have normalized. You are no longer prisoners of war, and you're going to be heading home. Good for you." And Garrick, like, clicks his heels together and starts walking off, and he says, "Everybody except for that guy." Garrick got singled out by Gul Dukat and is told so as much.
"The last time I checked, I was a Cardassian. But not a very popular one, I'm afraid."
The reason you don't get to go home is because Gul Dukat arranged this, and he said, "Don't send Garrick home."
It's why everyone refers to me as the Gul Dukat of the Greatest Generation. Gul Dukat holds grudges.
Yeah, you keep saying it.
Imagine being in this prison camp, and this is the first you're hearing it.
Yeah.
It's so crazy that I almost expected them not to believe it in this
right.
moment. Like that this would be some sort of bit that the Vorta
yeah.
were pulling.
Yeah. They are underhanded trickster people.
Yeah.
We know that about them.
Yeah, it's true.
But maybe the Cardassians don't as much?
Yeah, hard to say.
Like the Cardassians have only ever gone in to like go to war with them and then been in prison.
The idea is so absurd on the surface that I felt like most of the way through the episode, I was still thinking in the back of my mind, like, what are they trying to do here? Like, this can't be really the thing.
Yeah.
This can't be the plan. I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop.
If shoe fits, wear it.
We cut to Cardassia.
Yeah.
A wide shot of Cardassia, and we see that Gul Dukat is tweeting.
We've seen this establishing shot before, I think, where...
Yeah, like, I like it.
Cardassia has the Big Brother monitors everywhere, and Dukat is addressing all of Cardassia with a sort of Andy Rooney desk piece. "A lot of people are worried about us joining a murderous plutocracy, but I'm not. I think this is going to go great for Cardassia, and I'll tell you why." Kind of that type of thing.
Remember when you could go to any restaurant and get a slice of pie? Whatever happened to that?
I'm going to bring that back to Cardassia.
"Make Cardassia strong again."
And this is a great scene in the program because it totally undercuts whatever doubts you may have about the plan being real or not. Like, the moment I start having doubts about whether or not it's actually going to go down, we cut directly to Cardassia and we see that the plan has been implemented.
Right.
There
Gul Dukat is in fact the head of state. They're watching it on CNN from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's like making really extravagant promises like, I'm going to eliminate ISIS. All of the middle class manufacturing jobs are coming back to Cardassia, all of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun to cut to the wardroom to get the react shot. But it isn't the only problem that Sisko is dealing with. There's also the saboteur on the station because they're still kind of rubbing their bruises about the whole failed graviton emitter situation. Their attempts to close the wormhole in the episode before has instead strengthened the wormhole in a sort of weaponized speculum. Like the wormhole will remain open forever and there's nothing they can do to close it.
Yeah. And over the course of this episode, they keep opening up panels and finding Sabot all over the station. So, you know, they know that the problem is not solved. And Bashir Gold Edition speaks up and suggests that they get the blood screenings started up again. Sisko's like, yeah, we should do that plus phaser sweeps. And I wondered, like, they never show them phaser sweeping people.
No.
I feel like they should.
That doesn't sound pleasant. Look, guys, I know you're busy doing this lab work, but we need to shoot you.
Yeah.
Just on stun. Just hold still. You'll come to in a moment.
Yeah.
God, that's gonna suck.
Yeah. Not fun. Goldacott. So back in the prison, they are forced to give Garrick the job of rewiring the circuitry, and what they discover is that Garrick has sort of a Charles Bronson in Great Escape problem, which is that he's terrified of enclosed spaces.
That's right. Yeah, very familiar storyline here.
I don't like it in here. It's sweaty and closed off.
Not a little light behind these panels.
Every time the Gemini come back, you push the cot back in place and I'm stuck. There's that one weird Breen out there. I don't like the way he looks at me.
What's the Breen doing out there? Does he say anything? Makes me nervous.
He looks like a bullshit version of the bounty hunter Leia dressed up as in Star Wars.
Boy, is that the truth. You just buy the costume at a Halloween store?
It's really crazy, right?
Yeah, it's spot on.
It's like the company that makes costumes but doesn't get the licenses.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's like given a generic character name, like Refrigerated Alien.
Yeah.
You know.
People are getting impatient with the speed of Garrick's work, and after this moment, everyone pivots into feeling a great amount of empathy for Garrick, because later on it's revealed that he has a very hard time with these closed spaces, but
yeah,
doesn't happen until later on. It's at this point that the guards come in and drag Worf into the ring, where he will begin a series of fights out in the fight dojo.
Choose your pain.
They're going to give Martok a break, and Worf is taking over. Worf is actually been looking forward to this, which I can understand, you know, like having something to do while you're in jail sounds like probably better than having nothing to do in some ways.
Yeah.
But what he has to do is just fight an endless string of Jem'Hadars to the death.
This is where your conditioning pays off.
I really liked how the game mechanics of this were established in the last episode. Like we saw Martok reaching for these columns and tapping them. But that was not explained at all until this episode. I thought that was a nice bit of television making.
I've been bagging on Worf a lot as a character, but I want to be clear that that Michael Dorn is and always has been really good as him. And I think this is an episode that is a great reminder of like just how fucking hard it has to be Michael Dorn and to fight for an entire episode. Like these are all compound move fight scenes that he does, and
right.
He's both hitting and getting hit and acting hurt and tired and still delivering dialogue. Like this is a good Michael Dorn episode. He really does a lot of good things in it.
There's a huge amount of choreography and practicing for and executing that stuff takes a lot of dedication
and a lot of time. Like you see so little of the fight when compared to the probably hours it took for him to practice for those fights.
Right.
Yeah. Big stuff.
Yeah. So he dispatches the first Jem'Hadar that he fights pretty quickly and says, is that the best you've got? And they're like, no, he was the worst we've got. You're going to work your way up.
Yeah, Worf, this is World 1.1.
Round two, fight.
Back on DS9, Kira and Zial discuss the situation by a gazing window. Zial's missing Garrick and mad at her dad at the same time. And then Kira says something really interesting, which is you can't judge people by what they think or say, only by what they do. Really?
Yeah. Hmm.
I thought that was an interesting take by her.
So I'm going to have to make all my Thanksgiving dinner table arguments about how drunk people get and not about how they vote?
Yeah. Yeah, that's not going to go well. We don't get a lot of time to marinate in that comment before a shitload of Klingon warships decloaks off of DS9, one of them containing Gowron.
They request permission to dock, and without any hesitation, Sisko grants it.
Permission granted.
Yeah, this really seems like a calling all cars situation, a Wolf 359, if you will, in progress.
Right. So Gowron is in Six Bay when Sisko catches up with him, and we get the download, which is basically that like the ticks are being used to keep Dukat's promise. They are running all of the Klingons and Maquis out of Cardassian space, and Gowron basically had to turn heel and run to keep his fleet intact because they were so badly overwhelmed. And this is a great opportunity for Sisko to pitch Gowron on rebooting the Khitomer agreement.
The treaty between the Federation and the Klingon Empire is dead.
Gowron's plan is very Admiral Hansen-y. Like, he seems very willing to push all his chips in, like, right here and now.
Yeah.
He's like, I withdrew the fleet to Deep Space Nine. We'll make our last stand here. Like, all of this seems very familiar.
It really
and
does.
Sisko sort of pivots him into a revival of the Khitomer Accords, as you say. Like, why not combine forces and make sort of a super Wolf 359, if you will.
It went so great for Sisko last time.
Yeah, no kidding. God, this has got to be very traumatic for him.
I love that he just has an iPad with Khitomer Agreement 2.0,
yeah,
like ready to go for Gowron to thumbprint on.
Yeah, hold on, Gowron. It's not picking up my face. I've got to type in the code.
Take off your sunglasses. That might help.
The arrival of the Klingon fleet is concurrent with a couple of changes that we see around the station. One of them is like you just see a lot of security walking around with Dustbuster XLs.
Yeah.
It's looking fortified and ready. And I think the episode does a good job in just making you feel low-key tense like that. It's not the shopping mall vibe that we have gotten in most episodes on the promenade.
Right. We cut into a runabout and Bashir Gold Edition is fiddling behind some panel, and that is just a wordless scene. It's left for us to wonder what that was about.
I think he's just looking for some sunglasses you might have left there, right?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
You leave some sunglasses in the center console.
Yeah. I took them off to get into my telephone, but I forgot to put them back on.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A bucket.
A pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my living state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
Back on Camp 371, the fighting continues and Worf is 5-for-5, which seems pretty legendary at this point.
Yeah.
He has broken some ribs, though. And that makes me ask the question, does Worf have double the ribs of a human?
Oh, man. Do you think? Just double everything?
Like a shark? And teeth?
Oh, yeah. Does he have a second row of teeth behind the first row?
If he has double the ribs, then he really can't suck his two cocks, right?
He just has to have twice as many removed.
Right.
Hardly conclusive, Mr. Scott, since Klingons have no tear ducts.
I thought it was nice to see all the blood coming down his forehead, but I wished that there was like a boxing coach style dynamic between him and Martok where he would like get back in the corner of the ring and like get coached up, and then like somebody would be trying to like patch those loaf wounds and you know, keep them closed because it's messing up his sight or whatever.
It's so there for the taking. You're right. Like that kind of thing. That kind of storytelling has got to be very attractive to the show, but it does not choose that lane.
I wish like the Jem'Hadar being a terrifying enemy could be so enhanced if you made the case that this was like a blood sport that was being broadcast and like lots of Jem'Hadar were watching and there was commentary and stuff.
Yeah, I wondered the same.
The idea that there's just like 11 Jem'Hadar stationed on this dumb asteroid and Worf has now killed 5 of them. Like, I don't like it. I think that this is like very interesting, right? Like the Jem'Hadar are supposed to be this like force of nature enemy where they're like the toughest soldiers that we've ever encountered. Worf has, with his bare hands, dispatched 5 of them now. Wouldn't that be a blow to the Jem'Hadar psyche?
You'd think. I wonder if Worf ever thought of going full Risa here. Like, you know, you guys are on this prison and you're just taking the prison life for granted with all these fights. There's serious stuff going on outside these walls. Maybe if I turned off the weather control unit, you'd be a little more focused on the important things.
Everybody's like, oh, Worf is such a bummer. Just trying to enjoy ourselves on this desolate asteroid.
I didn't go to that meeting in the Neptune 5 conference room.
This is Risa for the Jem'Hadar. They love coming and working at the prison camp.
Yeah.
It's nice for them to abuse prisoners.
Feel like you're onto something. It's like some little tweaks would serve to juice this up a little bit.
Yeah.
As it is, I mean, it's exciting and hard to watch Worf get his ass kicked this way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's some meat on the bone.
A parallel conflict is happening behind the wall where Garak is working away at this at reprogramming this transmitter. And we've established that it's like really hot and uncomfortable back there also. So he's kind of like pep talking himself as he does this work.
This tunnel is mine as much as anybody. I dug it, I built it, I was buried many times. I go when I want.
And Bashir is like making him take 15-minute breaks for every hour of work he does and stuff. You know, they're very eager to move the process along as fast as they can, but it's not a survivable environment back there.
Inside the wall, Garrick's sort of the soldier in the foxhole psyching himself up for his lady back home.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like he's talking to himself. He's thinking of Z'al and like trying to psych himself up into making it back home to her. Like there's a lot of that.
He's got a real zeal for Z'al.
There you go, Ben. There's your title. That's a great title.
Thank you. I think I'm editing this one, so it's up to me, but
when we cut back into the cell, like we do a lot of cross-cutting between the fight in the ring and inside the cell, because inside the cell, they're sort of looking to see if the guards are distracted.
Yeah, and going like,
yeah.
When the police come around.
And when we cut back into the cell, we hear a banging from the inside, and that's a concern because Garak is usually a little more careful than that. And it's the sound of a breakdown inside that Garrick's having.
Yeah.
Garak is, by all accounts, the only person to fix the transmitter. They have got no one else who can, and he, at this point, is a mess on one of the cots.
Yeah. I always have the subtitles turned on when I have the episode open when we're recording, and one of the subtitles in this scene is, in like brackets, banging continues.
That's great. You know, a subtitle writer has got it. That's got to give him a smile.
Yeah, that's a fun one for a subtitle writer. So yeah, like, Bashir has to go in there and rescue Garak and put him in a bed and there's a little mini McLaughlin group between Bashir, Worf, and General Martok where they're like, boy, this does not seem like it's going to work. Like Garak is going nuts in there and I think we need to start strategizing about another escape plan.
Back on DS9, the space around the station is still filling with ships, but the sabotage continues. and it is putting everyone on edge. And one other thing that puts them on edge is an incoming FaceTime by Gul Dukat for Sisko. And Dukat has a great deal for Sisko. How would you like to join your friends and family in a business opportunity that involves the Dominion? It's really cool because you get to live. But if you don't choose to work with us, you're going to die.
Imagine a pair of scissors sharp enough to cut through a penny. That's kind of what the Dominion offers.
Everyone needs a pair of scissors, right?
Yeah.
They practically sell themselves.
They sharpen themselves.
Dukat is a hell of a salesman here.
Yeah.
But Sisko is not even trying to hear this, and in fact tells Dukat to bring it on.
Yeah, he says, literally, come at me, bro.
Now watch this drive.
I think if you're Sisko, you have to at least float this up the chain of command, right? Does he have unilateral authority to decline an invitation into this?
It does not seem like a captain-level decision.
No, it does not. And if we're talking about existential style destruction, which certainly seems on the table, like once Bajor and DS9 fall, I mean, what is going to stop the ticks from swarming into the entire quadrant and then the next quadrant after that? Like, I think you have to at least float it.
Yeah, but while I agree that there needs to be some acknowledgement of this in the scene, I do think that Sisko is probably operating from established Federation policy. Like, yeah, they're already on a adversarial footing with the Dominion, and there may just be directives that are like, you know, the Dominion may try and like make overtures of peace in the guise of turning us into client states of theirs, but we're not interested in those kinds of opportunities.
Right. And there's nothing like amplifying the tension through an administrative act. So, like, I understand why they didn't do it for that reason.
Right.
Sisko's like, well, I can't give you an answer now.
I have to ask my boss, and he's going to have to ask his boss.
I'm sure you understand. Yeah. When they have a hearty laugh about bureaucracy.
Why don't you give us, I don't know, 6 months to think it over?
What are you doing now?
Back on Camp 371, Worf is now 7-for-7, and Martok is psyched because Worf is going for the record.
Martok is talking about getting songs written in Worf's honor.
Yeah.
Maybe
that's what you want when you're a Klingon.
Throw some Bashir references in there.
Yeah.
That's all Garrick needs to hear, right? He doesn't want the song to also mention the cowardly Cardassian that failed to get the escape plan going.
Martok is not the corner man that is concerned for his fighter, because his fighter, Worf, is pretty certain he can't continue. He's ready to quit on a stool.
Oogie's ringing that bell, I can't concentrate.
And Martok is like, no, man, we're not going to be able to write these songs unless you get back out there for your eighth fight.
Yeah, he's really pep-talking Worf, and Worf is like, I don't want your life.
Save it, Dad.
Martok and Worf, though, are in agreement about one thing, and that is Garrick's courage.
Yeah.
Like, they are seeing Garrick struggle mightily.
I wish they had said this to Garrick, though. They're like huddling with each other, like whispering, like, wow, what a baller. Like, facing your fears like that. That's fucking savage shit. And Garrick is the one that needs to hear it.
To apply the boxing metaphor again, like, Garrick gets off the mat that is his cot, stands up and goes back into the ring, which is the area behind the wall.
Yo, that's good, baby.
Nobody's spraying water from that weird water bottle into Garrick's mouth.
Yeah. Someone needs to do that. Maybe the Breen could do that. I'm sure the Breen have pretty cold water, right?
Oh, yeah. That's nice and icy cold.
Yeah. Delicious. On DS9, O'Brien and Bashir are rapping about things.
We're never going to get all these Klingon ships up and running.
I have every confidence in you, Chief.
Now that makes all the difference then, doesn't it?
This is a fun bit of comedy in an episode that is not funny at all, because Bashir steps in it with his reference to darts at an inopportune time.
We're facing a major interstellar war, and you're thinking about darts?
And
is this,
there's no
is
reason...
Is this here to be an example of how O'Brien was an idiot not to see something was wrong?
Well, life must go on.
I don't know. Like, there's still no reason to suspect that he's a changeling at this point, because Bashir at certain times in the series has just not been socially on the same level as his environment.
Right. Because he's talking about like, hey, I ordered these great new darts. And O'Brien is like, dude, like our fucking station might be under attack. Like I had to send my wife and children to the planet in the hopes that that will be something that keeps them safe.
Right. It was a reminder that this isn't Face-Off, you know? Like, it isn't Dr. Bashir. It isn't someone playing Dr. Bashir who knows Dr. Bashir.
Right.
It's a Gold doing it. And so I think that's an interesting take on the body snatch that's happened here.
I mean, he does a good enough job that nobody thinks Bashir is weird.
Yeah. This is one of a couple of scenes where we cut around the station and just sit with characters who are expecting the worst.
It's that calm before the storm. And it, like, I feel like these scenes are really smart writing because they all feel like the moment before all hell breaks loose and just all out war starts.
This is an episode that watched Best of Both Worlds and learned from that moment where Picard walks the ship at the Pulse of Nebula. Like that's one of the best scenes in that episode, and it's that pre-war stuff that extrudes the tension. You're right.
That's a conceit, but it's a healthy one.
We get Zial and Quark, and like weirdly Zial is, you know, like the like classic feminist criticism of Star Wars is that Princess Leia has never met Luke before, but she's comforting him when Obi-Wan Kenobi dies after her entire planet got destroyed.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a similar vibe here where Zial is like, don't worry, Quark, maybe the Vorta are going to be good bar customers.
For all we know, the Vorta could be gluttonous, alcoholic sex maniacs.
I never thought of that.
The unfounded positivity of youth, basically, is how I read this. Like, she has no idea. She has no life experience or worldview to speak of.
Well, and also just women always being put in the place of comforting men.
Yeah.
And men that don't deserve it. Case in point, Quark.
Quark is dreading what is to come, but I think if you were to list the people on the station who had a possibility of positive outcomes, it may begin and end with Quark. That might be a very short list.
Yeah, he's the cucaracha of the station. He's going to make hay no matter who is in charge.
He's going to be serving cement mixers made out of the white.
Right.
All day.
Another Coco no-no?
Well, and like, you know, like Dukat wants the station. Like that was part of his FaceTime to Sisko. So
yeah,
it's not like it's just going to be Jem'Hadar and Golds. It's like, it's going to be...
Yeah.
Cardassians are a familiar customer to him.
Break out the Kanar.
I bet he's still got a bunch of Yamek sauce down there in the storeroom, you know? Those guys love that shit.
I love that each time we cut to the exterior of the station, the space keeps filling with more and more ships. Because at this point, the Starfleet Task Force has arrived, including a Hood class out there, which you know had to be pretty disappointing for everyone on that ship.
I saw two Hood class starships, so at least one of them could be the Hood. Is it possible that there's multiple Hoods?
There is no fucking way DeSoto is anywhere near this scene. This is way too hot for him.
Yeah.
Sensors report the USS Hood is closing on an intercept course at high warp.
That's odd.
He's like, what about if I patrol Vulcan?
You know what? Someone's got to make sure Vulcan's safe. Might as well be me.
You know, not all heroes wear capes. Some heroes do finger guns and wink at their buddies.
Just think about the morale hit that would happen if we lost the Hood and its captain.
You know, everybody talks about how the Enterprise is the flagship. They're the best and brightest. But I think what also provides comfort to the men and women of Starfleet is that the Hood is out there chilling the most for all you sinners.
The Hood's out there and it's wearing the Big Lebowski robe and it's like it's flowing like that Bajoran sail ship around the saucer section. Yeah.
The Hood abides.
Back on Camp 371, Martok is making the case that punctuality is an honorable trait because they're just sort of waiting for the next contestant to fight Worf. And that end boss is revealed in short order to be Ikatika, which is sort of like the main guard who's been talking all the shit up until now.
Yeah, he's the top Jem'Hadar.
Yeah.
They got their catchphrases, right? He says,
"Victory is life."
Worf says,
"Today is a good day to die."
I can't believe that there have been what is going to be 8 fights. And in none of those fights, Ben, we get the straw ripped from a Jem'Hadar's neck and the milk squirting everywhere.
You got to go for the straw. That is just such an Achilles heel.
There's got to be a rule to this game. It's like fighting someone in middle school where you're like, no punches to the face.
Yeah, but that's like if you're in a prison camp, you're not observing the Marquess of Queensberry boxing rules.
I know. I'm agreeing with you, Ben. It is insane to me that in this context, there could possibly be a don't grab the straw rule. It's
dumb.
Does
Worf ever go around on like off days and say, "Today is not a good day to die"? Has he ever just been like at the mall with Dax trying on a new pair of shoes? I just turned to her and said, "Today is not a good day to die."
There was a time when that line really jacked me up, but I'm too cool on Worf now. That doesn't do anything for me when I hear him say it.
That bums me out. I really liked it in this episode.
You know what would have won me back over again is if he pulled out a Kataka straw and like squirted it into his eyes to blind him.
Oh!
And then he like holds a thumb like over the opening of the straw to get like extra distance and he starts like shooting people outside the ring.
Oh yeah, I like to get it from 2 different Jem'Hadars at the same time and spray it all over my face.
Like, what would happen if Worf grabbed the straw and then blew into it?
I guess if the end of the straw that came out when you yanked on it was out of the canister of Ketracel.
Oh yeah, you're just blowing Ketracel.
Well, but if it came out of the canister and you're blowing into the Jem'Hadar, you could give them what is that? Like an oxygen bubble in their blood?
Oh yeah, you'd give them an embolism,
an
right?
An embolism, that's the word I'm looking for. I was going to say aneurysm, but that's not it. It's embolism.
That's the reason you flick the hypodermic needle before you plunge it into your skin.
I'm told that that's a bit overblown though, the flicking the hypodermic needle. That's not really necessary in most... in like modern medicine, but they do it because it looks great on camera to like squirt a little bit out.
Well, I mean, that's true.
Pre-medicine can get you pregnant just as...
I'm so grateful to you for that.
You mean for that warning?
No, just that reference every time.
More.
Here, buddy. Stop. Hammer time.
I wanted to talk about Prime Bashir in the prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I thought this yet last episode or if I brought it up or not, but I feel like Sittig is playing Bashir really differently in the prison camp.
Oh.
Like, it doesn't feel like Prime Bashir to me. And I think that that's intentional. Like, he's kind of playing Gold Edition a little bit more true to expectations And I think that his prison camp performance is a little like a little fucked up and intentionally weird because he's been in jail for a month. He's been ground down and made very desperate. And I think it's like a subtle distinction, but I think it's there and I think it's really good.
The Cardassian, where is he?
Outside, I suppose.
I think I can really get with that. I think one of the ways that if you're playing two parts, if you're playing the same person twice, and one of those characters is someone masquerading as that character, but you want to make it appear as though the masquerade is effective, you play off of that one by making your other character more neutrally affected, right? And this jail scene, Bashir, has a very neutral affect in a way that I think serves the gold edition and serves maybe the quality of that subterfuge in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's a very zesty character, I feel like.
Zesty!
He really has. He's got a lot of elan for what he does. And this, the prime Bashir that's in prison just feels muted in a way.
Yeah. Well, the reason you ask is because Bashir pops up in this scene where the guards come in looking for Garrick. And in so doing, they find the pry bar that they've been using to pull the panels away. And it's a scary moment because the finding of the pry bar means that the chances of discovering Garrick back there are pretty good.
It's like they found Andy Dufresne's rock hammer.
You know, like what if they just found Andy Dufresne's rock hammer? That would be bad.
Just worn down to the nubbin.
Yeah. And, he tries to explain it away.
They cut back to the yard and, like, the scenes of Garrick dropping wall panels out the bottom of his pants.
Yeah. So this is where we start to intercut with all of the excitement back at Deep Space Nine pretty rapidly because we've got Romulans showing up. They're gonna join the fight. And they start to detect shit tons of Dominion and Cardassian warships entering the space. And they're like, all right, it's popping off. Back to prison camp. And Bashir is still trying to explain the pry bar, makes a self-stealing stem bolt joke, and the Jem'Hadar turns around and vaporizes one of the Romulan prisoners. And then is like, I'm going to vaporize this other Romulan prisoner if you don't tell us. And Bashir's like, okay, fine. Like, we hate the Romulans.
The Jem'Hadar haven't discovered that weapon holster technology that only allows the wearer to be at the proper angle to pull out the weapon from its holster.
Yeah. Yeah, because the Breen grabs one of the guns. There's a mutual vaporization event.
Yeah. Yep.
That Breen is gone. I wanted to get to know that Breen.
Yeah. It's a rarity to both shoot at the same time, simultaneously. Most of the time it's just one and then maybe the other.
Yeah. But another Jem'Hadar gets vaporized and Bashir neck stabs the last one.
Yeah.
And so Garrick is able to finish the work. We get a cutaway to Worf in the Thunderdome fighting the final boss, and he is really getting his ass torn up. You know, he's like getting knocked to the ground, and Martok is like, man, like you have done everything you needed to do to demonstrate your honor. And this is when this Jem'Hadar says, I'm actually yielding the fight.
Yeah.
He proves himself to be the one Jem'Hadar out there that is with honor.
I cannot defeat this Klingon. All I can do is kill him.
Pretty great story about the Jem'Hadar, you know? Like, Ikataka's appreciation for Worf here makes me respect the Jem'Hadar a lot.
Right.
And the way that he puts it, I think, is also really well done. Like, killing him wouldn't give him the satisfaction of winning the fight. He can't win the fight.
Yeah.
And he knows it.
And that's when the Vorta orders Ikataka and Worf executed. And the other Jem'Hadar don't flinch here. They start licking shots, and that is just when Garak gets the connection made, because suddenly everybody is beaming out, and they beam up to the runabout, and Garak is very quick to get in the driver's seat and start driving them away. Bashir, has Martok take Worf back to the mysterious back compartment of the runabout, and they start heading back toward Deep Space Nine as fast as they can. And Bashir is like, we got to get a message to the station.
Do you think they recovered the runabout that Quark and Odo crashed on that mountain planet? Do you think they ever got it and repaired it?
I don't know, because the station is now like getting ready for all-out war with all these Jem'Hadar and Cardassian warships that are headed in. And they're like, all right, spin up all the runabouts. And three runabouts are available.
Yeah, and I feel and like that's why I asked.
The station has only ever had three as far as I know. But then we also hear about runabout pad E, which implies that there's room for up to five runabouts. If not more.
Yeah. Yeah, and it sure seems like there is a dearth of parking possibilities, you know, just out in space.
Yeah, that's kind of like my neighborhood.
Space Nine. Yeah.
Especially on Wednesdays and Thursdays, because, you know, the next morning is street sweeping day.
So. Yeah. Very inconvenient.
Yeah, it's really rough. If we have like a social obligation on a Wednesday night, it's like, fuck, do we take a taxi? Because almost spending the like $30 to take a taxi seems better than driving around the neighborhood for an hour when we get home to try and find a parking place.
Have you really done that?
Yeah. We certainly have. Gosh. Because we don't have off-street parking at our apartment.
That's brutal.
Yeah. You know what? I moved to Brooklyn so that I would never have to think about parking again for my entire life. And my wife made me move to California, where it is the only thing anyone thinks about.
Sure sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's great. You should try it.
You really want to do this? Here, now, okay, let's do it!
Back on Deep Space Nine, they are expecting this Tick fleet to arrive any moment. But they're nowhere to be found. Like, they're everywhere and nowhere. O'Brien is, like, scanning, and they seem like they should be there, but there's nothing to lock onto. It's very confusing.
And it is right then when O'Brien receives a signal from the G-Quad, from Dr. Bashir, and they're like, Bashir? Where's Bashir? And they ask the computer, where's Bashir? Bashir's not on the station. Where was he last scanned? Which is a follow-up question to where is Dr. Bashir that should always have been asked in the history of Star Trek, right? Like, right. Where is X? X is not on the ship. It has been a plot point countless times. And this is maybe the first time that the follow-up question is, what was the last place X was at?
Yeah, great job, O'Brien.
And Bashir is on a runabout. And without any more information at all, Sisko orders the Yukon destroyed by the little D with extreme prejudice.
Major, you have new orders.
Not to capture, not to bring back, but to destroy.
Yeah.
You know what? There is a significant dollar value attached to that runabout.
I know.
I feel like someone needs to say it.
You're crazy, Bert. Do you know that?
There is like a 1.5 minute little story arc in this episode about Bashir Gold Edition flying toward the star at the center of the Bajor system with some kind of bomb on board his runabout to cause the sun to go supernova and wipe out the combined Klingon Romulan Federation fleet. And Bajor and Deep Space Nine all in one go that is foiled within that 1 minute and 30 second plot. Like we get the idea and it's over a minute and 30 seconds later.
The runabout's been destroyed.
It really blew my hair back. It's how how much is compressed into this moment.
That is like a Star Trek Discovery level of just like, this happened now. Whoa!
I mean, also related to Discovery, we asked a question recently of how much damage a single bad operator could do in the Federation.
Yeah.
And this...
Yeah, and the Trouble with Edward episode.
Edward Larkin! I think this is the new leader on the board. The destruction of a star, a planet, a station, and a fleet.
Yeah. And it's a real here. It's a real clean operation. Like all of the warp signatures they've been detecting have been faked. So the Dominion plan was basically get everybody that would oppose us in one place at one time and blow their star up. And we'll just take them off the board entirely.
Yeah. Very elegant design to this plan. I really admired it.
Yeah, that could have been...
In a way that I feel like most of the Founder / Vorta / Jem'Hadar plans are. They hang together really neatly.
Yeah. Wolf 359 would not have shit on the destruction of the entire Bajor system.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Is it called the Bajor system? Have we ever learned the name of the star that Bajor orbits?
I don't think so.
That seems weird, right?
It does. We rarely see it, even. I think it's been in a couple episodes, but yeah. I like that Kira has to take the little D to warp inside the system to go chase down Julian Pachangeling. That was fun. There's like that moment, too, where Dax and Kira are like, should we do it?
If we don't, there won't be a solar system left.
No other choice.
No other choice. All works out.
We get a lot of buttons at the end of this ep. Basically a tuxedo shirt of buttons.
Yeah. Where we have an NBA player's suit number of buttons.
Yeah, we have a Steve Harvey amount of buttons at the end of this episode. Because we've got to go around the horn and we've got to see... We've got to see everyone's story concluded here. At Quarks, we see Garrick returning to embrace Zial. O'Brien talks to Bashir about how weird it was that he didn't know that he was friends with the wrong Bashir. We get Dax canoodling with Worf. We get Sisko and Gowron discussing the plan ahead, and that plan is one that includes returning to a permanent Klingon presence on the station.
Gowron's a lot like me in that he will look at a page of information that a government wants from him and fill it out and sign it without really reading any of the fine print.
Yep. Yeah, they're going to need a rep from Klingon Co. to stay, and that person's going to be Martok. Martok is going to stay on the station.
Yeah, Martok's going to be a series regular.
It's probably for the best, right? He doesn't have a lot of depth perception anymore after the whole eye thing.
Yeah.
He's going to be terrible with darts, right? Keep him out of Quarks.
He and Worf have a lot of esteem for each other, so that's who it's got to be. And I guess it's the final button on the episode is a FaceTime between Dukat and Sisko, and Dukat is like, this is going to be great for the golf resorts I operate. You know, we're going to get a lot of government business at those.
Uh-huh. Doral is booked completely.
Yeah. And Sisko's like, you sold out your own daughter. And he's like, she sold herself out. She sided with the wrong people. Loyalty to me is the only thing that matters. It's not loyalty to the state or loyalty to the people. And that's when Dukat says, make Cardassia strong again.
They both sort of mutually threaten each other with what will happen tomorrow. And that's it for now.
Yeah. Did you like the episode, Adam?
I like it when the stakes are existential, and it felt good to have an episode where shit is going down in such a way that a star could explode.
Yeah.
And a planet could be destroyed. Like, great, big stakes. I love that. And I also
That's like a 2-inch thick steak.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
A tomahawk steak.
They were really good this episode and in the episodes leading up to it at doing that thing where they made you equivocate about your feelings for Gul Dukat. Like maybe he's an anti-hero that we could like. Maybe, you know, he's not as bad as we think. And it serves the double cross in a fun way.
Yeah.
I didn't see it coming. And I didn't see it coming because I think it was set up so nicely.
Yeah.
And it was satisfying when it finally came. And seeing Dukat installed as beloved leader, like it makes me smile in how awful it is. Like Gul Dukat is back to being a bad guy. He took the DNA test. He's 100% that bad guy again. And I like it a lot. It's the realization of all of the setup. And I think the setup paid off. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that especially just everything in that last episode where suddenly Dukat seems like, oh, maybe we should be friends with this guy. And yeah, it's a really fun episode. It's a very fun No Founders stuff episode.
Yeah.
Like I guess Gold Edition Bashir is a founder, but the fact that Change Leader is not there, that they're so far above this kind of shit is really fun storytelling as well. And
yeah.
I really like this whole arc.
Why don't you see if we have any priority one message that we'll really like, Ben?
Okay, we could do that.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first priority one message is of a personal nature. It is from your dork boss, and it is for Smith. The message goes like this. Hey, Smith, whether we're interrogating the Ferengi as a parody of 90s American culture or shaking our figurative canes at today's youth, I'm so happy to have you as my number one. Let's science the heck out of some plant diseases. Wouldn't want to do it without you.
Wow.
You know what I like about...
A reference to The Martian. A good Matt Damon, Jessica Chastain movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that movie a lot.
I liked the book even more than I liked the movie.
I also read the book. I liked it.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
The preferred time frame for this message is before the end of DS9, and that is just a great time frame. Good job, Dork Boss.
Yeah.
You're guaranteed to get this one read on time.
We're heading into December, and I think we're pretty free up in terms of P1s for December. So if you have a December P1, go ahead and head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron right now.
Yeah.
Our second P1 is from Manasserit. And it's to Short Pants. It goes like this. To the best guy in the quadrant, a message from the fever dream past in the days after we brought home baby number 2. We love and appreciate you so much. Thanks for being a 24th century partner in a 21st century world.
You know, I plugged Manasserit into the Google.
Yeah?
And what came back was Manasserit is a genus of damselflies in the family of Calopterygidae.
Ankylosaur.
Wow. Damsel indeed.
Yeah, that's fun.
I'm also seeing a lot of like Greek or Roman bas-reliefs in this
yeah.
Google search. It must have some like mythic association.
When I plugged in to Google short pants, I got pictures of shorts.
Yeah. Greeks and Romans did not have that technology.
Well, if you were to plug in MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron into your web browser, you would be taken to a place where you can send personal messages to people about either something personal or a fun business opportunity you might have.
Yeah.
Both of which go a long way to supporting the ongoing production of this show.
They sure do.
Gotta get that.
Gold press
platinum. Am I right? Yeah. Am I right?
Gotta get that gold press
platinum. Platinum.
Hey, Adam.
What is that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda.
I like Ikataka as my drunk Shimoda.
Mm-hmm.
I like that he has got that resting, not happy to work here face. Whenever he has an interaction with Worf or Martok or whatever, he never seems cruel. He just seems kind of resigned in a, these are the rules of my workplace kind of way. And even when he gets into the ring at the end, it feels like it's not about him at that point. I try to figure out whether it's sort of a suicide by cop way out of a work situation he doesn't like, but I don't know if it's that. I think he feels an obligation to seeing this scene through to the end personally. And I think he has a very specific code of honor,
right,
that he's prescribing to. And it feels obligatory in a strange way, as obligatory as anything else that he does. It is a very interesting performance by him. I really liked his work.
I did too. I think he really rises to the occasion of having like noticeably better loaf than all of the other alien second string characters in that,
yeah,
in that sequence.
Yeah.
He was really good. Yeah. My drunk Shimoda has got to be Sisko for the snap decision on destroy the Yukon no matter what. Just like he has so little information when he makes that, order. And just felt like that was a real drunk Shimoda move.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Yeah, hope he's right.
Yeah, he's usually right.
Well, I hope you have another episode of Deep Space Nine to tell me about, Ben. What are we watching next?
Well, Adam, what's next is Season 5, Episode 16, Dr. Bashir, I Presume, when Bashir is chosen as the model for Starfleet's holographic doctor program, the process threatens to expose a dark secret from his past.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Adam, why don't you load up the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets, and tell us how, just how, we will be experiencing this episode.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Ben, I've loaded up the game. I've loaded it up big time.
You dropped a load on the game?
What the game is telling me at this point is that we are on square 45, where exactly one square ahead is a Coco Nono episode. And a few squares beyond that, a space butthole, which would take us all the way down to a fuck it, we'll do it live ep.
Wow.
Safe to say, danger ahead. A number of fronts.
You're a real one roller in my experience.
I do like to roll a snake eye. And here we go. I have indeed rolled a one, Ben. Just like clockwork.
What the hell?
Drink is the antidote.
You knew it was going to happen. You knew, I knew, everyone knew I would roll that one. And so next episode will be a Coco Nono episode. You and I both know a Coco Nono episode is a special tiki-themed drunkisode where you and I will be making tiki cocktails and doing an episode of The Greatest Generation while enjoying them.
Yeah, I'm a big, big fan of the tiki theme of fake culture, so I will look forward to this with great anticipation.
You just insulted a lot of island nations with that comment, Ben.
That's a lot of island nations that...
Pretty disappointing.
White ex-service members vaguely culturally appropriated when they got back from World War II.
Well, sounds
yes,
like
I'm sure this will be a
matter,
real
Ben.
Slap in the face for Samoa and Tahiti and Fiji.
Boy, just nothing like cruising into a good time with a lot to have on your conscience. So thanks for making it fun, Ben.
Yeah, you know, any experience of tiki that doesn't involve a little bit of white guilt just isn't my style, Adam.
Yeah. Yeah, that is most definitely your brand. Well, I am looking forward to that And I'm looking forward to experiencing that episode guilt-free, Ben.
Wow, fuck. You're a real piece of shit.
Well, I personally would feel extremely guilty if we didn't thank the many people who made this episode possible. Of course, I'm talking mostly about the Friends of DeSoto who go to MaximumFun.org/donate to continually fund the production of this show.
Yeah, we should also thank Bill Tilly, who makes hilarious trading cards about this show. He posts them on Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen, where Adam is at CutForTime and I'm at BenjaminAHR. We also got to thank our buddy Adam Ragusea. He used to be the person that makes all the music for this show, but now he's a big-time YouTube sensation. And if you search Adam Ragusea on YouTube, you can find all his cooking videos. They are very good.
Support for the show comes from MaximumFun.org/donate, but it also comes from the purchase of our many fine merchandise items.
That's true.
Max Fun Store has them, and I recognize that this episode comes out during what is, for most people, known as the holiday season.
Mm.
So if you were looking for a gift for a special friend of DeSoto, I would encourage you to visit the Max Fun Store to find something fun for them. We've got shirts and glasses and hoodies and all kinds of fun things.
All kinds of them. Get into it.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine that will be getting into the creme de banane heavily.
Ooh, shit. Wow, Gauntlet just got thrown down.
Yep, I'm throwing it. I want a creme de banane based cocktail.
Fuck.
A guilt-free creme de... I want the name of the cocktail to be guilt-free good time. right?
Man, you gotta get the Giffard Banane du Brésil. That's the good stuff. Tastes like bananas, yeah. Foster.
All right. Well, if some friends of DeSoto want to drink along with us, that's the kind to get.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.